Good morning. As always, so good to see each of you who are here in person, those join us online as well. I hope you'll be helped today by our time in the Word. And as we've already said, if you're our guests here today, and there's anything we can do for you, anything we can pray with you about, any questions you have, we want to be a help to you in any way we can. That's our desire, certainly. As we close our year, I'm going to deviate away from our series in Luke, and I want us to think about this idea today out of the book of Exodus. So if you have a paper copy of God's Word, and you open it up, at the very first of the Bible, we're going to find the book Genesis. You go just the next book over, you'll find Exodus. But you're also welcome to just pull out your phone, Google Exodus chapter number 16. Exodus chapter number 16. That's where we're going to be this morning as we have kind of a concluding idea here or message for the year. And I want us to consider God's gracious and undeserved care in our lives. God's gracious and undeserved care. So I have two questions I want you to consider. You'll see them on the screen here. How has God been to you this year, 2024? And how do you think God will be to you in 2025? Or maybe we'll say it this way. How do you think God will treat you in 2025? Now, I ask those questions, and again, I get they're both steeped in subjectivism, meaning we're kind of finite and closed and limited in our perspective. But I want you to consider those because for some of the room, you might be tempted to answer that it has been a hard year, or it's been a bad year, or it's been a difficult year, or a year you wouldn't want to repeat. And no doubt, there's some real reasons for that. Maybe you lost your job unjustly. Maybe you encountered some kind of physical malady or affliction you didn't anticipate. Maybe there was a severance of a relationship or a loss of a loved one. There could be a multitude of reasons that we would be tempted to answer the first one. How's God been to me this year? Not that good. It's not gone the way I wish it would. I really expected God to act differently towards me. Or, if we're not careful, we would think, in fact, I did X, Y, Z, so I thought God kind of owed me a better year than I had. For others, you might say, man, things were great. They couldn't get any better, and I'm going to trust that 2025 is going to keep rolling in the same direction, and God's going to keep that blessing train flowing my way and keep me kind of on easy street. To both parties this morning, and no doubt there's a spectrum in between there, I would just call us this morning to see the truths of our passage to better hopefully understand our good God and his kindness towards us, but then understand that how he relates to us doesn't always fit our criteria of what is good and kind. Did everybody hear that? Our idea of God is often very skewed and self-centeredness and subjectivism. And so when he does not act in accordance with our desire or what we thought would be helpful or enjoyable or even, quote, right, there's a part of our mind, because we are tainted by sin, to say with accusation towards God, what are you doing and why are you doing it? This morning, I want to look at the book of Exodus and hopefully have a principle that we'll walk through that will help us in the really, quote, good times of the upcoming year and our reflection on this past year, but then also help us hit the challenging times to remember who our God is and how his care for us is always right and sufficient. Even though we live in an unjust world, yes. Even when other people do evil to us, yes. Even when we screw up and kind of botch things for us and others, yes, God is gracious to us. And so, my friends, we're going to jump into the book of Exodus. Let me give you a little runway before we hit it here. In our chapter, we find the nation of Israel has been delivered out from under the control and slavery of Egypt. Pharaoh, by God's really imposing it upon him, has finally released the nation of Israel. He changes his mind. He pursues them. They go through the Red Sea. God allows Israel to go through unscathed in a miraculous manner and then collapses the Red Sea upon the Egyptians as they follow. And so they're on the other side of the Red Sea here in this portion of Scripture. They have seen God do the miraculous in delivering them, a group of 2 million people, from their captors. They've seen God do the miraculous in guiding and protecting them. They're not a military, and the largest military force in the world historically at that time was following them, and he took care of all of them. And now they're on the other side of that, and all that lies in front of them is desert. What are they going to do? How are they going to be cared for? That's where we find ourselves in Exodus 16. So pick up there, if you would, and look at verse number 4. Exodus 16 and verse number 4. Then said the Lord unto Moses, God has appointed this man named Moses to be the leader and the guide of the people of Israel out of Egypt and into the promised land he has for them. And so God says to Moses, behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you, and the people shall go out and gather a certain rate every day, that I may prove them whether they will walk in my law or no. And it shall come to pass that on the sixth day they shall prepare that which they bring in, and it shall be twice as much as they gather. And Moses and Aaron said unto all the children of Israel at even, then ye shall know that the Lord hath brought you out of the land of Egypt. And in the morning, then ye shall see the glory of the Lord, for that he heareth your, and what's the word there? Murmurings. Remember, God has been providing and caring and guiding and protecting this group of people. But right before this account, you know what they've been doing? Complaining. Complaining about where they're at, complaining about what they have, complaining about what they don't have, complaining about the people that God's put around them, complaining about God even letting them be where they're at. And so they have a complaint towards God, complaint towards Moses and Aaron, who God has had leading them, a complaint about their situation and their circumstances. It's just not right. It's just not enough for them. And God says here, and this should give us all a little bit of that hairs on the back of our neck stand-up feel, God heard it all. And note what he says there in the middle of verse 7. And what are we that you murmur against us? This is Moses saying this. And Moses said, this shall be when the Lord shall give you in the evening flesh to eat, in the morning bread to the full. For the Lord heareth your murmurings, which you murmur against him. And what are we? Him being him, Moses and Aaron, the leaders. Your murmurings aren't against us. They're against the Lord. And Moses spake unto Aaron, send all the congregation of the children of Israel, come near before the Lord, for he hath heard your murmurings. It came to pass, as Aaron spake unto the whole congregation of the children of Israel, that they looked towards the wilderness, and behold, the glory of the Lord appeared in the cloud. And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, I've heard the murmurings of the children of Israel. Speak unto them, saying, at even ye shall eat flesh, and in the morning ye shall be filled with bread, and ye shall know that I am the Lord your God. And it came to pass that at even the quails came up and covered the camp. And in the morning the dew lay round about the host. And when the dew that lay upon it was gone up, behold, upon the face of the wilderness there lay a small round thing, as small as the hoarfrost on the ground. And when the children of Israel saw it, they said to one another, it is manna, for they wist not what it was. And Moses said unto them, this is the bread which the Lord hath given you to eat. Here in our passage, you have this murmuring, complaining group about the care of God and not only who he is and his nature being manifested to them, but what he is doing and who he has put around them to help them and guide them and encourage them and strengthen them on their journey. And instead of gratefulness and thankfulness, reflection on what God has done for them, you find them doing what? What's the word we read over and over? It starts with an M. What was it? Murmuring. Complaining. In our household, it's called whining, right? Here's what God has done. Here's what God has continued to do. Yeah, but is it enough? You have this complaining group of people. And if you're like me, sometimes, you know, it's always easier to be upset with somebody else who's whining and complaining rather than our own whininess and complaining, right? If you think about it, you just had Christmas this last week. Can you imagine if your son, daughter, grandson, granddaughter, niece, nephew, significant other, whatever it was, you gave them a gift, they open it, and they're like, what I really wanted was, I think your Christmas might have been a little bit down, right? Or maybe feisty, I don't know. Maybe it would have gotten exciting, right? Because unthankfulness gnaws at us when it's expressed towards us. But here in this passage, it shows us, oh, how easy it is to have that same attitude and heart towards God. But why I bring that up is to show you the different response that God has than what you and I are prone to have. In the midst of this whining, complaining, murmuring, unthankful, disobedient group of people, God could, as we'll talk about in a second, bring some level of chastisement. Instead, though, he exercises mercy in his provision for Israel because he wants to teach them to trust his goodness and to obey what he has said, to grow in their trust of him. This is an idea from the passage I want you to think about. It's this: God, in his provisional care for us, is always better to us than our obedience deserves. It's always better in us than our obedience deserves. Now, I want you to catch this, because when I say his provisional care, again, I didn't say him giving you what you want, me what I want, when we want it, how we want it. No, and that's not even what it was here for Israel. God in his care for Israel did what was right in his understanding in holiness, and he did it when and how was best for Israel to have their faith strengthened and grown and moved away from disobedience and complaint and criticism. So, my friends, when we think about God and his gracious, undeserved care in their lives, here in our passage and context, but then also in our own lives, I want you to think about provisional care. That provisional care begins with a divine caretaker. It begins with a divine caretaker. It's rooted in his very nature. When it comes to how God was going to interact with Israel and how he still interacts with you and I today, his care is rooted in his nature, or his conduct is rooted in his nature. Here, the nation of Israel was going to be reminded of what God could do versus what he does decide to do. Check out in verse number four there, where he says, "Behold, I will rain down what? Bread. I'll rain down bread." The God of the universe, who needs nothing and is owed nothing to no one, as bad as the English is there, he decides to handle this unthankful and undeserving group in what manner? He rains down bread. Man, if it's me, if it was you, we'd be talking about raining down what? Some fire. Rain down some judgment. Oh, you have it so bad? Let me just remind you how bad it could be, right? In our household, sometimes that happens. Oh, you didn't like dinner? How about no dinner? Oh, you don't like that? How about double a portion of that to remind you to be thankful, right? God here elects to rain down bread instead of fire. In this moment, in his just understanding, it's better to display a level of mercy and kindness rather than what could rightly come, which is a level of chastisement or judgment. He reminds them all throughout this passage, through Moses, through Aaron, that he knows what's going on in their heart and what's been coming out of their mouths. Nothing is hidden from him. They have been a selfish people, openly questioning the kindness that he has displayed in his care for them and in the leadership he has provided to them. And in immaturity and selfishness, they've done what? Griped and murmured towards God, and they focused it on people they can attack, mankind, the people that are in front of them. Particularly in this case, it's Moses and Aaron. There are other times throughout the Bible God does interact with his people and bring about a level of chastisement, but here, in his wisdom, he's using kindness instead of chastisement on this occasion. So, my friends, I just want to say it up front so it sticks in our mind here. When we answer the question of how has 2024 gone for you and what do you hope to see happen in 2025, I want you to root your understanding, or at least your perception, or at least how you're viewing it. Start with the right lens. The God of the universe is a God of kindness and generosity and goodness, and that is rooted in his holy nature. He is apart from sin. He is not tainted or tethered by sin like you and I are. And so sometimes when we view what we view in our life in the past, in the present, thinking about the future, we are too prone to look at him with the wrong lens rather than remember he is always good and he's always right. Is faithful in this passage to bring bread to his people, to remind them that he is kind, that he is faithful, that he is good. And all of it's for his glory. Remember, God didn't want them to be petty and focused on not only what they perceive to be their problems, which are just easy solutions in God's economy, nor to be petty towards attacking individuals that really have no power to change anything on their behalf anyway, right? I mean, how much provision can Moses and Aaron in this passage provide for them? Just two dudes in the desert with them. It didn't matter if they had a Costco card or not. There's nothing around. But rather than go to God with their concern or request or grievance or heaviness, they just complain and criticize in their unthankfulness, and they attack the people God has put in their life to try to help them. See, the occasion was never about them getting what they want, when they wanted, how they wanted. And the occasion was never about, wow, the leadership stinks, they should have, how could they should have known better. The occasion was to draw the nation of Israel to do what? Look to God in reliance and see his glory in his answer. To be awed by him and what he's willing and able to do, not only currently, but what he is able and capable to do in the future. This was a learning moment on purpose from God to them. And my friends, in your life and in my life, it's important that we remember that God in his care, it's rooted in his nature, and how he's interacting with you is intentional for his desire in your life. So often, we're quick to look at our needs and do what? Focus on ourselves, aren't we? I mean, it's human nature, isn't it? I'm selfish, you're selfish. I think we could all admit that and understand that very clearly. The longer we live on this earth, the longer we see that in ourselves and in others. We just had the holiday season, and if you tried to get into a grocery line at any place, people were glad to walk in front of you, weren't they? Nobody else? Just me? All right, everybody walked in front of me this last week, I guess, right? Oh, that's what we do as human beings. We're so incredibly self-centered. And if we're not careful, we look at our needs and focus on ourselves, and because what we're going through, legitimate or illegitimate, we start to harbor ideas that aren't healthy and aren't right. Listen, we go through real issues for sure. Nobody's denying that, and nobody's disputing that. But it's how we go through those issues and how we look to God in those issues that will determine the outcome, my friend. Those issues that either we have created through our own ideology or that are very real in our life can throw us into a drama-filled, self-destructive spiral because of the discomfort that we are experiencing or that we perceive we're experiencing. But all those moments are just supposed to be on-ramps back to the Lord. Your frustration in the middle of your day, if you're a follower of Jesus, is to point you back his direction and reliance and need. What did he say the very beginning of the Sermon on the Mount? Blessed are the poor in spirit. There is a neediness. There is a dependency that you and I are created to have and frankly created to enjoy, which is we have a creator God who is good, holy, and loving, who longs for a relationship with us, who established a means for a relationship through the Lord Jesus Christ, his death on your behalf, his forgiveness reconciling you, making you right with God. And these moments of frustration, these moments of lack, these moments of injustice, they are opportunities in the middle of the tragedies or travesties of life. And why does God allow it? So that we would be reminded again and again he is our gracious caretaker. I want you to recognize today, it does not matter who you are, where you come from, what skin color you have, what socioeconomic background you're coming from, how rich or poor you are, how educated you are, or how educated you are not, I want you to recognize that God is a gracious and good God to you. Well, I'm not his follower. I'm not sure, frankly, I believe in this God of the Bible business. My friends, he declares through the Bible that he is kind even to people who reject him. He reigns on the just and the unjust. He is kind to sustain your existence. Even if you don't think he exists, he is kind to you. And if you're his follower, I hope you could easily recognize and say, yeah, my God is very good to me. More than I could ever hope him to be or deserve it to be in my life, I desire to grow in my trust and dependence on him. My friends, he has promised us all throughout the scriptures that he is a gracious caretaker. Think about what Jesus said in Matthew chapter 6, verses 20 really through 33. He reminds us, there's so many things you're worried about. You worry about this, you worry about that, and on he goes describing a list of things we worry about. But he reminded his listeners, birds don't really have a lot of long-term plans. Grass doesn't have the cognitive ability to make any plans. Flowers don't have any control over their own existence for the most part. But who caretakes for all of them? God does. So if God knows every bird that gets hit by an 18-wheeler on the 75... how much more does he intimately know all the intricacies of your thoughts and of your life and of those that are in your life as well? God is a gracious caretaker. Think about what Peter said. Peter said that though the devil roams around looking to devour people, and what does he mean by that? Seeking their spiritual alienation from God forever to keep you from salvation in Jesus, and also for you as a follower of Jesus, being pulled away towards temptation and ruin in your life away from God's desire. Though the devil has a real and intentional malicious purpose for you, you know who caretakes for you through all that? The Lord Jesus does. He is a caretaking good God. He reminded us through the psalmist in Psalm 75 that though there's politicians who promise this and though there's injustice in nations over there doing that, that God in his clarity knows what's going on and God in his ability will judge all justly because he is the caretaker for all humanity. In 2 Corinthians chapter 9 and chapter 12, he reminds us that he is a gracious God and we can tap into and join his graciousness through our life, through his generous work and his generous abundance he gives us as we become open-handed with what he's granted us. We can enjoy his provision and beyond. If that weren't enough, in Hebrews chapter 4, you know what he said? You have a great high priest who knows what you're going through, has gone through it to the maximum degree possible that you could ever think about going through it, and he calls you to come to him with your frustrations, worries, and concerns. See, there's not an element or aspect of your life or my life that God in his goodness is not caretaking for. Here in our passage, these people who are kind of out in the middle of nowhere, wondering to themselves, how are we ever going to get anywhere and how are we going to ever have anything to eat? Oh, man, it was so much better the life we had in slavery. Oh, man, do you remember those pagans beat us, whipped us, starved us, and we didn't know if our kids were going to survive at the end of the week? Man, life was better then. That's the accusation they have towards God. But God in his kindness continues to care for them. It's rooted, my friend, that kind of faith, that kind of confidence, that kind of trust in his nature, not the circumstances you see and feel. I do want to just say this so strongly for our young believers in the room and our younger generation in the room. Life is not going to be great. Not even an agreement from anybody in here? Like everybody's like, Pastor got up a little bitter this morning. Whew, whew. Christmas stunk at his house, apparently. Whew. No, let's be honest. Let's be real. Let's understand the reality presented from the scripture. Do we live in a sin-cursed world? Yes, we do. You have the desire of sin in your own being. You have hurt people. You have wronged people. You have harbored things against people. They've done it to you, haven't they? You've had bosses be unjust with your pay, unjust with your hours, fire you, wrongly demote, wrongly promote someone else. You've had it happen. You've had health issues that you don't think you should have and don't have any explanation for why you have it. And on we could go. Life isn't always great, is it? Now, if we're not careful, and I say this particularly to our younger brothers and sisters in the faith, you can let that tunnel vision based on circumstances start to distort and pervert your view of God instead of it being the other way, which is in the midst of these ugly and difficult and undesirable circumstances, they force me, they push me to look to God in desperation and see that in his character, that what he is and then what he does in his conduct, I may not understand it. I frankly may not understand any of it. I may never understand it. I may never even enjoy it in this life. But I can look to him in faith and have a level of confidence and assurance about what he is doing, even if I don't understand it. You are on the track to bitterness and disillusionment if you won't do that. And Pastor makes it sound like life is just going to be terrible all the time. Oh, no, goodness, no. Ecclesiastes is clear. We've got so much to enjoy and have a good time with in life, right? I mean, there is so much to be thankful for, and life is awesome a majority of the time if we let it be. That doesn't mean it's going to be great all the time. That doesn't mean it's going to not come with heavy moments that hit us like big tsunami waves. In those moments, just like Israel is being called to here, we go back to the nature of our God and his provision and how he's providing, what he's providing, who he's providing, when he's providing. And we start with his character before we start being concerned and questioning all of his conduct. It's not that he can't take the questions. It's not that he doesn't welcome us with our frustrations and questions. Absolutely, he does. But we need to start with it rooted in his character, in his nature. But secondly, my friends, recognize this morning. God here says, behold, I'm going to rain down bread. But I want you to see in verse 4 what he says about it. How is he going to rain it down? It's a very interesting way he phrases it here in verse number 4. He says, behold, I will rain down bread from heaven for you, and the people shall go out and gather what? A certain rate. When we think about God and his kindness, his gracious, undeserved care, how he provides for us provisionally over and over again, it's important we remember he does it in his way, supernaturally, but he does it in a sufficient way on purpose. He does it in a sufficient way on purpose. I like the way Warren Wiersbe said it. He said it like this. In our pilgrim journey through this life, we live on promises and not explanations. What was he meaning by that? That God, in his plan to care for us, he'll do it in the way he deems best, in a way that grows our faith, and again, a way that expresses his glory. God's plan to provide nourishment for these 2 million-plus people was going to be done his way, at his rate, and according to his time frame. I love how he says it here in verse 4, I'm going to rain down heaven. Again, God's our provider, but then God promises to only do it a certain daily appointed amount, and then in verse 5, he makes it clear, I'm going to give you enough on the sixth day that on the Sabbath day you won't need to go out. In their time, God had established that they would work 6 days. On the seventh, they were to do no work. They were to reflect spiritually about God and his kindness and his care and reflect upon him with other people. So God has told them, I will give you daily care, daily food according to my decree, and you won't get any on the Sabbath because you'll get double the amount on the sixth day. So God in his faithfulness supernaturally supplied and provided for them. Well, how did he do this? Well, in verses 13, we read it, 13 and 14 and 15, we see God giving them maybe what we would call quail to eat. Maybe it's a different kind of bird. We're not 100% sure. And then he's going to give them some kind of bread-like substance. This is incredible because these birds that are described here in verse 13, they were common in the Egyptian and the Red Sea coastline. They would come across this time of year to Egypt to try to get the wheat or try to get the corn, and the farmers would scatter them away. Of course, they didn't want them on their crops. And so what their custom was is they'd fly by day picking and grabbing, then they'd rest somewhere by night. God, who supernaturally intends over all the universe, makes sure that these birds stop and go overnight and become the meal for the Israelites the next day. It's a miraculous feat, and you think about it, how many chickens would it take? That's maybe our Western idea here. How many relatability, right? How many Chick-fil-A nuggets or sandwiches would it take to feed 2 million people? That's a catering bill I don't want, right? But I want you to just try to put it in a relatable way. God every day is going to provide meat for 2 million people. Well, did he just make all these birds fly to them? He create more birds? I think you're missing the point. God, in his supernatural provision, faithfully supplied every day what his people needed in a sufficient manner to call them back to dependence, thankfulness, and reflection upon his glory. If that weren't enough, he provides for them some kind of bread-like substance. We're not 100% sure what exactly it was. Some may think it was a wafer or a cookie. Some think it might have been like some kind of substance that was on some of the trees around there. Again, if we want to get really particular and worried about it, at the end of the day, you're missing the point. The point is God cared for them in his way, at his rate, his time. Numbers chapter 11 tells us that an evening dew would cover the camp. Then God would make sure the manna was upon that dew, and then there would be a morning dew that covered it. So making sure this meal was completely taken care of. It was completely protected as it should be. And then the sun would rise, that top dew would burn off. They'd collect the manna. Anything left would burn off with the morning dew underneath it, and it would all be gone. And this is the process God miraculously provided for them each day, every day, providing maybe as we think about it medically, carbohydrates and proteins, all that they needed, they would have. My friends, how did he do this? He did it every single day. They would go out, and he even gives them how much they were to get so that it was always enough. He gives it a per-person amount, and whether they all went out individually and per-person or whether it was gathered together and they came together and they got it disseminated to them, the amount that God had said. Again, it could be either way. I don't know that it's necessarily nearly as important to understand that as much as the real lesson is what? Obey your God, have trust in his provision, go out and do what he has said. It was to teach them about supernatural provision and the sufficiency of God. And his plan, the family with one kid would have enough, the single person would have enough, the elderly would have enough, the people with too many kids would have enough, the young people would have enough, and at the end of the day, God makes it clear there'd be no lack for anybody, and there would be no waste left over. He would take care of it over and over again at a certain rate. Now, we read this and we think, wow, that has to be so neat. That had to have been so cool every morning to get up and see God's provision again and again and again and again. All they had to do was go pick it up. How hard? Wow, what a bunch of crybabies, right? They couldn't even go out and get the miracle every single day. And I mean, we probably have a bit of a point there. But how often do we operate with the same kind of ideology towards God? Where you're at in your life, God in his kindness has provided. I get he gives us agency. I get we are blessed to live in Western economy. I'm not denying any of that. We all understand that. But often, the human factor says what? But what about? Or if I could only. We used to live and minister in an impoverished community, and everybody's always waiting for that big payday to come in somehow. You know, if I could, you know, if God just would give me $10,000 today, man, my life would be so much better. You know what I would do if I had 10 grand? Oh, man, if I could just hit the Powerball once, some of you deacons can relate, no doubt. If I could just win the lottery. Man, if I just had a great Aunt Ethel who loved me and left me a lot of her inheritance, God, why did so-and-so get $500,000 and not me? Why did so-and-so get the six-figure job and I'm over here just working myself to the bone? If we're not careful, we want God to provide for us in a way that would bring ease and comfort, maybe at the expense of reliance and trust. Remember in the Proverbs what he said? Feed me conveniently, God. And what did he mean by that? Remember that verse? He talks about, I don't want to be poor and still. I don't want to be rich and forget you. Care for me at a way that keeps me relying on you. See, the people of Israel here were being provided for and cared for in a daily way that would force them to be reliant upon God. They'd have to remember over and over, God, you are my caretaker. Friends, the truth is, no matter your income bracket, that would always be a struggle, perhaps. Because if the struggle isn't, God, I need, or I got to pay, or my insurance is due, or the mortgage, or if I could just get reestablished, or if I could change my credit score, if that isn't the issue, you face a whole other series of questions when you got a lot. What do I do with it? What's the best route to do with it? It's really not that much money. How do I avoid this pitfall, that pitfall? My point is, friends, God in his kindness supplies our needs, and he is good to do so, whether we agree with how he does it, and we want to guard our hearts against looking to him and asking for him to provide in a rate or in a manner or in a way that would move us away from reliance, trust, and therefore being open-handed as a generous steward. The people are going to be reminded every day, by faith, by faith, by faith. You maybe remember the name George Mueller. He had a variety of ministries he had a partaking, but he's best known, obviously, for his orphanage. He started his orphanage, it's recorded according to him, with about 50 cents to his name, but knowing God desired for him and others to minister to the growing orphan population there in his area. And so he founded the orphanages there throughout Bristol, and God brought in, he calculated over his time there, £400,000, which would be our equivalent today, about $7-8 million. George Mueller had a very interesting approach. According to what we can tell historically, he did not go out and shill for the orphanages. He didn't come to this church, and to that church, and to this church, and to that church, and if you could just for your love gift, and if for your love gift, and if your love gift. George Mueller had this approach. We will pray, and God will provide. Didn't mean that they never talked about it with anybody or that nobody was aware of the orphanages of Bristol, but their primary idea was, we will pray, and God will provide. The stories you read of the orphanages having no food until the morning of, or no dinner until the evening of, or no ability to pay until the moment of or before, are numerous. And here's Mueller's approach. He said this, and I quote, "The Lord seemed to always be on time. And the day he's not on time, I'll just understand it that he wants me to do something else." What faith? What faith in God, in his character, in his kindness, in his provision to say, I can trust God whether I've got 7 million in the bank or whether I've got 77 cents in the bank. I just want to challenge you and I today. I don't know what you got going on in your heart and your life and your finances and your situation. I really don't know. But God in his provision and his care has not forgotten or abandoned you. He is caring for you in a sufficient way. Do we need to do our part in agency? Sure. But God in his kindness has not forgotten about you, and he is still working in your life. Why? Because lastly this morning, the care of God always has a spiritual purpose behind it. Here in our passage, he says this in verse number 4. It says, "Behold, I will rain down bread from heaven for you, and the people shall go out and gather a certain rate every day." Note what it says there in verse 4. "That I may" what? "Prove them." That I may prove them. The idea of prove here is this idea of testing, showing proof. Something's being attempted. God in his desires trying to do what? Show the nation of Israel he is all he promised he would be, and they need to grow in their dependence upon him. As one author said it, the grand object of the being led into the wilderness was that I might receive a religious training directly under the eye of God. And the first lesson taught them was a constant dependence upon him for their daily nourishment. is looking for a singular instance here of obedience to his daily will in regards to their provision in their life. The proving isn't to reveal anything to the Lord, of course. The moment was to prove something to them and call them to obedience over and over and over again. Now, you would think that if God made it clear through Aaron and Moses to the people that they were sitting there and heard them say, hey, God heard what you said in your heart, and God heard what you said with your lips. He heard your murmuring. Here's what he's going to do. He's not going to bring judgment upon you. In his kindness, his mercy, he's going to keep providing you and providing for you in ways you could never imagine, both with meat and with some kind of bread. He is going to take care of you throughout this entire journey. You'll never want with the care of your God. You would think the response would be what? Thankfulness, yes, and obedience second. I want you to check out verse 19. Look what happens here. Chapter 16, look at verse number 19. And Moses said, let no man leave it till the morning. Verse 20 starts with what? Notwithstanding. Moses says, don't do the following. And then verse 20, notwithstanding, they hearkened not unto Moses, but some of them left it until the morning, and it bred worms and stank, and Moses was wroth with them. God says, I have a purpose, I have a plan, it's to teach you, it's to grow you, I will care for you, and they respond with, but will you really? Doubt. If that weren't enough, them holding it over and hearkening not, they didn't listen. If that weren't enough, they do the same thing on the next opportunity. So God says, don't hold me over day by day. Every day will be enough. You don't have to doubt me. Okay, let's doubt. All right, how'd that work out? It all rotted. It was terrible. Okay, we're getting closer now. Remember the sixth day, he said, get double because you're not going to get any on the seventh. There'll be no food out there on the seventh. And we would think that after they watched God be right on day two, they probably wouldn't push back on day six. But that's not the case, is it? I want you to pop down and look at verse number, what is it? Like 20, let's see here. Yeah, look at verse 22. It came to pass that on the sixth day, they gathered twice as much bread, two oars, one man. The rulers of the congregation came and told Moses. He said, this is that which the Lord said. Tomorrow is the rest of the holy Sabbath unto the Lord. Bake that which you do bake today, and see that you will seethe. That maineth overlap for you to keep until morning. And they laid it up till the morning, as Moses bade, and it did not stink, neither was there any worms therein. Moses said, eat that today, for today is Sabbath unto the Lord. Today ye shall not find it in the field. 6 days shall ye gather it, but on the seventh day, which is the Sabbath, in it there shall be none. It came to pass that there went out some of the people on the what day? So catch it. Has God already provided for them? Yes. Did God say, don't hold any over, it will be rotten and worthless, today's provision will be enough, don't hold yesterday's? Yes. Did they obey? No. They get to day six. Can we trust God? A majority, thankfully, from the passage seemed like the answer is, yes, we learned our lesson, we'll trust God. But there are still a few of them, a few turkeys, who do what on day seven? Better go out and get some food today. Even though I heard it, even though I know it, even though God has provided, even though we got double yesterday, still going to go out anyway. They went out and found there was nothing at all, just like God had promised. You see, in their unbelief, they were pushing back against what God had already called them to and already promised them. The point was, in his spiritual purpose, to grow their faith-based obedience. I want to be clear here. Their faith-based obedience didn't earn them God's provision and kindness and goodness. He did that because of his character and his nature. Their obedience gave them an opportunity to grow in their trust and then also grow in their testifying ability to the younger generation and to the pagan around them. My friends, today, I want you to consider what God is doing in your life in his provision and in his care, that it's rooted in his nature, yes. He's providing for you in a very specific way, yes. He knows your needs, and he calls you to come to him about those, absolutely. But my friends, he is calling you to trust him, to obey him, not walk away from what he said, not walk away from the people who try to help you and what he has said. He is calling you to faith-based growth and not to try to meddle with it with your own understanding. I can't tell you how many times I watch people when things get sour because of fill in the blank. Things get sour at work because of a pay rate cut, or because of layoffs, or because of a job assignment, or because of a new boss or a president or CEO or a board or whatever it is. And you know what they immediately start doing? God, why did you? God, how could you? I need a different job. I'll take any job. And next thing you know, they're making doubt-based decisions about God and his care and provision for them, and they start putting themselves in ways that jeopardize them spiritually in the proactivity in their family, in their gospel commitment through their church, in their investment for the gospel through other people in the community. And they jeopardize all that because God's care and provision all of a sudden wasn't good enough or wasn't right. I watch people with who God's put in their life to try to help them, whether it's a spouse, whether it's a parent, whether it's a brother or sister at church, a deacon, a pastor, whatever it is, and because they're not responding well to what God is allowing into their life, how he's providing, what he's doing, and they just start bucking against that they start going against what God has said in the Word about them and their relationships. They start getting selfish, frustrated, offended, and you know what that starts to do? It starts to tear apart and cause division in all these wonderful, blessed circles God has intentionally placed them in or dropped them in to help them. And if they're not careful, they find themselves just like the people with the rotten food, just like the people with no food there on that seventh day in unbelief. My friends, God and what he's doing in your life, rooted in his nature, sufficient in its provision, is calling you to grow in faith, not wallow in unbelief, not indulge yourself in unbelief, not find pity for yourself in unbelief. He's calling you away from that because he has better for you and better for me. If God in his kindness would care for 2 million people who, this isn't the only instance, whined, complained, criticized, murmured, and were angry with God and others, is God any less likely to deal with you in kindness and provide for you and care for you even when you struggle? I'm calling you today to realize that 2024 may have been an awesome year, or it may have been a trash year in your book. 2025 is unwritten. We don't know. None of us can control it to a certainty. And you may say, well, I don't know, but I really hope this happens. I really hope this doesn't happen. I really hope this person. I really hope that person. And I'm just here to call us back to God and his gracious provision will care for you. He will grow your faith. You can trust his heart with what's going on. But at those crossroads, beware. There's temptation to be unthankful, be critical, be divisive, to do that which is harmful to you and others. Lean upon what God has already said in his word about him, his work in your life, and then avail yourself to the people he's put around you to help you. If you're struggling, open up about it. Guess where's a good place to open up about it? The church. Oh, no, I can't let the church folk know my business, because if they know my business, they'll treat me differently. That could happen, because we're all frail people. But if anybody should know what it is to struggle, it should be the people where? Right in here. Can I tell you what you don't want to have happen to you in 2025? You're struggling. You don't tell somebody. And it just slowly worms its way into your heart and your mind, and your choices then sever you from the people who love you and help you. I've seen it too many times in families, too many times in church. Or you do open up, and somebody does try to help you, but because you are now frustrated that they know something about you, you're going to sever that relationship. I've seen that too many times in families and churches as well. God, he is good, he's kind, and he calls you to him. But then he puts other people around you to help you as well. And what you might face in 2025 is with the care of God and with the companionship
brothers and sisters in Christ outside this church for sure, and inside this church as well, ready to help you as just one imperfect person with the grace of God trying to go aside another imperfect person with the grace of God. Today, I want to call us back to the kindness and goodness of our God and his provision for us. Listen, my friends, as we close, the ultimate provision you'll ever understand or know about the goodness of God is not in a bank account. It's not in a house. It's not even in another human being, a person, a relationship. It's not in some situation, circumstance, or setting. The greatest care, the greatest proof, the greatest evidence you'll ever have of God's provision for you is in salvation, in the Lord Jesus. Jesus being willing, as Brother Tyler said earlier, to come to this earth and live a sinless life on your behalf and go to the cross. He was crucified. He was murdered by Romans. Why? Not because of crime he had committed or sin that he could be charged with. He went to the cross, innocent for the guilty, righteous for the unrighteous, because of you and I and our debt and our severance between us and our Creator. My friend, the wage of sin is death. You're going to face it. I am too. Everybody's going to die physically, for sure. But then there's something worse than the physical death. It's separation from God forever. That's the kind of death we're warned about more in the Scriptures. And Jesus was willing to bridge that gap and give you the gift of eternal life. But it's through him alone. Not him plus a baptism. Not him plus your good works. Not without him and with your morality. Not without him and with your intellect about what you believe and think is true about the universe. No, you cannot change your sinful status. You cannot change your sin nature. And so you need it changed by the only one who's powerful enough to do so, and that's Jesus. He lived the perfect life for you. He died your death, and he rose from the grave, and he offers you that kind of transformation. Forgiveness, eternal life, and change from the inside out.